Welcome to The Book Report. I'm your host, Elaine Charles. Ever pause to ponder that old adage, crime doesn't pay? For many of our favorite authors, crime does pay, and very handsomely. Look at today's bestseller lists. Crime thrillers often hold the top spots. Crime dramas rule at the box office and on the small screen. So many classic lines from crime stories have entered the vernacular. Go ahead, make my day. Keep your friends close and your enemies closer. And a personal favorite, book 'em, Dano, Murder One. Most of us are law-abiding citizens, so why this fascination with crime? Let's investigate with a look at crime dramas topping the bestseller lists. Today's lineup is not the list of usual suspects, but a diverse group of titles ready to entertain. Let's turn now to page one of the book report. First on the book report's crime scene, Joel Rosenberg's The Auschwitz Escape. As the story begins, Hitler and the Nazis are surging to power, and a terrible darkness is falling on Jacob Weiss's beloved Germany. When tragedy strikes during a night of violence, Jacob flees and joins rebels working to undermine the regime. But a raid goes horribly wrong, and Jacob finds himself in a living nightmare, trapped in a crowded car on the train to Auschwitz. As Hitler implements his final solution, Jacob must rely on his wits and a God he's not sure he believes in to somehow escape from Auschwitz. This work of fiction is based on actual escapes from the death camp. Several reviewers have called this a top select in the genre. Christopher Lane narrates.
In Paris, they said the Germans would never dare to invade France. They said the Nazis could never penetrate the Maginot Line. The 25-kilometer-thick virtual wall of heavily armed and manned guard posts and bunkers and concrete tank barricades and anti-aircraft batteries and minefields and all manner of other military fortifications designed to keep the Germans at bay. They'd convinced themselves Hitler would never try to move his panzer divisions through the forests of the Ardennes. Those forests were too thick, too dense, too foreboding for anyone to move tanks and mobile artillery and armored personnel carriers and other mechanized units through. But Jean-Luc Leclerc knew that they were wrong. Luke? Luke, are you listening? No one actually called him Jean-Luc, not since he was a little boy. His parents, his siblings, his grandparents, they all called him Luke. Now, though he still felt like a kid at times, theoretically, he was all grown up, married, two small daughters, a mortgage, a parish, ever-growing responsibilities. Luke, are you even hearing a word I'm saying? Suddenly, he realized his sister, Monique, was trying to get his attention, and he was embarrassed. Oh, yes, of course, I'm sorry. What do you need? Would you turn out the lights and bring those napkins and forks? She asked with a warm smile as she stood in the center of the cozy kitchen and lit the candles on an exquisitely decorated and no doubt scrumptious homemade birthday cake. Luke did as he was asked and followed his sister into the dining room, singing with the others and trying his best not to let his fears show on his face. He was not there to ruin his niece's birthday party. Little Jacqueline stood there in her pink dress and shiny brown hair and black leather shoes. She didn't know war was looming. She knew nothing of Herr Hitler's invasion of Poland the previous September, nor did she know anything of Hitler's invasion of the Low Countries, Belgium and the Netherlands, 3 days earlier. The adults had shielded the children from their worries over their older brother, Philippe, who lived with his family in Brussels, the Belgian capital. Jacqueline didn't know they had not heard from Philippe since the German invasion, that Luke feared Philippe was dead. All she knew was that she had a house full of family and friends and a cake with candles and a new doll from her beloved Uncle Luke and Aunt Claire and her cousins Lily and Madeline. She was so innocent, he thought as he sang, so unaware of the darkness that was settling upon them all. At least she had an excuse. She was only 4. What was her parents' excuse? Monique was 32. Her husband, Nicholas, was 36. They were a sharp, attractive couple, well-educated and, by all measures, worldly wise. They'd both been to university. She had studied nursing. He had been to the Sorbonne and had become a gifted physician. They were well-read. They had a little money socked away. They had interesting friends in high places all over Europe. How could they not see what had happened to Philippe? How could they not see the grave danger they were in? Why did they not flee while they still could, away from the border to Le Chambon, to be with Luc and Claire? Happy birthday, dear Jacqueline. Happy birthday to you. With that, the room erupted in applause and smiles and laughter and great joy. Jacqueline looked radiant, and Luc knew that his wife Claire and their two daughters would have loved to be at his side. Claire had made the doll and written the card, and Lily and Madeline had colored it and made it special for their beloved cousin. But despite their protests, Luc had forbidden them to come. The Belgian border was no place for his family, certainly not now. As Jacqueline made a wish and blew out the candles and Monique cut the cake, Luc dutifully distributed the forks in his hand and then stepped back into the kitchen to get a couple bottles of cold milk.
That was The Auschwitz Escape by Joel Rosenberg. Harlan Coben is a Book Report favorite and an author we've spoken with on several occasions. Missing You is Coben's new standalone novel. It's a cleverly conceived thrill ride with cops and cons. There's a taken-from-the-headline sense to the story as 40-year-old NYPD detective Kat Donovan discovers an old love and stumbles upon a gateway into a mysterious crime world through an online dating site her friend urges her to join. January Lavoy turns in a gripping performance.
Sunglasses honed in on Kat and began to make his move. He didn't so much walk toward her as glide on his own slime. Stacy suppressed a giggle.
This is going to be good.
Hoping to discourage him, Kat gave the guy flat eyes and a disdainful frown. Sunglasses was not deterred. He bebopped over, moving to some soundtrack that was playing only in his own head.
Hey, babe,
Sunglasses said.
Is your name Wi-Fi?
Kat waited.
Because I'm feeling a connection.
Stacy burst out laughing. Kat just stared at him. He continued.
I love you small chicks, you know. You're kind of adorable. A spinner, am I right? You know what would look good on me? You.
Do these lines ever work? Kat asked him.
I'm not done yet.
Sunglasses coughed into his fist, took out his iPhone, and held it up to Kat.
Hey, babe, congrats. You've just moved to the top of my to-do list.
Stacy loved it. Kat said, What's your name? He arched an eyebrow.
Whatever you want it to be, babe.
How about Waffle? Kat opened her blazer, showing the weapon on her belt. I'm going to reach for my gun now, Waffle.
Damn, woman. Are you my new boss?
He pointed to his...
Because you just gave me a raise.
Go away.
My love for you is like diarrhea, Sunglasses said. I just can't hold it in.
Kat stared at him, horrified.
Too far?
He said. Oh, man, that's just gross.
Yeah, but I bet you never heard it before.
He'd win that bet. Leave. Now.
Really?
Stacy was nearly on the floor with laughter. Sunglasses started to turn away.
Wait, is this a test? Is Waffle like a compliment or something?
Go. He shrugged, turned, spotted Stacy, figured, why not? He looked her long body up and down and said,
The word of the day is legs. Let's go back to your place and spread the word.
Stacy was still loving it.
Take me, Waffle. Right here, right now.
Really?
No.
Waffle looked back at Kat. Kat put her hand on the butt of her gun. He held up his hands and slinked away. Kat said, Stacy?
Hmm?
Why do these guys keep thinking they have a chance with me?
Because you look cute and perky.
I'm not perky.
No, but you look perky.
Seriously, do I look like that much of a loser?
You look damaged,
Stacy said.
I hate to say it, but the damage, it comes off you like some kind of pheromone that can't resist.
They both took a sip of their drinks. So what won't I like? Kat asked. Stacy looked back toward Waffle.
I feel bad for him now. Maybe I should throw him a quickie.
Don't start.
What?
Stacy crossed her show-off long legs and smiled at Waffle. He made a face that reminded Kat of a dog left in a car too long.
Do you think the skirt is too short?
Skirt? Kat said. I thought it was a belt. Stacy liked that. She loved the attention. She loved picking up men because she thought a one-night stand with her was somehow life-changing. It was also part of her job. Stacy owned a private investigation firm with two other gorgeous women. Their specialty? Catching, really, and trapping cheating spouses.
That was Missing You by Harlan Coben. C.J. Box is the best-selling author of 17 novels, including 14 in the critically acclaimed Joe Pickett mystery series. Set in Wyoming, the series is unique in taking on controversial issues, including environmental issues, animal rights, and biotech mining. Box is a Wyoming native and has worked as a ranch hand, surveyor, fishing guide, and small-town newspaper reporter and editor. He's won the Edgar Allan Poe Award for Best Novel, as well as numerous other prestigious literary prizes. Today, we'll speak with him about the new title in the Joe Pickett series, Stone Cold. Welcome, CJ. It's great to have you back with us on the Book Report.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me back.
For those new to the series, introduce us to Joe Pickett.
Well, Joe Pickett is a Wyoming game warden. He's married. He has three daughters. He's been around now for 14 novels. And as a Wyoming game warden, he's involved in not only, you know, Wyoming game and fish regulations, but often gets involved in other kinds of crimes and investigations, which is very much like real game wardens in the state. And in Stone Cold, he is being sent to the northeastern part of the state, the Wyoming Black Hills, to investigate a landowner there who is suspected of also being a contract hitman.
Right. How has Joe evolved from the early books?
Well, he's certainly gotten older. The books take place in real time. So every year he's a year older. His kids are a year older. He's not quite as naive as he was when the series began. He's got a little tougher skin, and he's a little bit more skeptical because he's been kind of betrayed a few times. But he still has the same basic tenet, which is that once he gets involved with something, he sticks with it until he sees it through.
Right. Well, Joe has three daughters, and you have three daughters. Do your kids weigh in on how you should write the girls?
You know, they do. Every time I get a manuscript done, I send it to my two oldest daughters as well as my wife, and they all weigh in on different aspects of the book, but particularly on the family interactions. And they offer good advice, and I always take it.
I have to say that as a parent myself, you really write surly teens very, very well.
Oh, well, thank you very much. I've had some experience in that direction, although my daughters are older than the fictional ones in the book. But I've spent a lot of time, you know, over the years listening to them, speech patterns, what concerns them, and try to reflect that in the book.
Right. Joe is so closely identified with his environment, Wyoming and the Rocky Mountain region. Do you ever fantasize about placing him in a totally different locale?
I've considered it, but I don't think it would work very well. And I like to have Joe. The state of Wyoming is huge as it is. It's nearly the size of France, and there's only about 600,000 people in it, and a lot of diverse terrain and cultures. So I'm perfectly happy keeping him there and moving him around a little bit. I think it would be kind of a stretch to have Joe Pickett, show up in other locations or other countries, although I kind of like the idea of going to Italy for a while and having, having a book set in Italy, but that wouldn't work with Joe Pickett.
Hmm. Do you rely on a group of game wardens to keep you accurate on Joe and his work?
I do. There's two in particular that I run every manuscript by so that I can get the details of the Game and Fish bureaucracy correct. And I've gone on several ride-alongs with other game wardens so that I can, hear stories, see their methodology. And they love to kind of funnel me ideas or themes that they think should be in a book.
Right. On a serious note, in the book, Joe's oldest daughter, Sheridan, is a resident assistant in a dorm at the University of Wyoming, and she's faced with a serious dilemma that has to do with guns. I realize the West has a different attitude towards guns, but how have readers reacted to this part of the story?
There have been some very interesting questions and observations, and it comes from the dilemma that obviously exists in real life, is that when a student is kind of identified as potentially dangerous, in this case it's a guy who dresses all in black, plays violent first-person shooter games, has no friends, and kind of creeps people out. What can you really do until this guy actually does something, commits a crime? And the answer is not much until something really happens. And it creates a dilemma that every time Joe Pickett throughout the book, when his cell phone rings, he's scared to find out what's going to be on the other end.
Hmm. And again, there was a sort of a gun issue there, too. Do you want to talk about that?
Well, yeah. In the book, at the University of Wyoming, students are allowed to have guns, but they must be checked in with the campus police department and kind of in a locker there. And in the book, a couple of guys go hunting, and they don't check their guns back in, and they take them to their dorm rooms, and then they go missing, which, of course, creates another dilemma.
Yeah, that's kind of a big pill for us to swallow.
No, it's a real ethical and moral issue in that is it more likely that there would be something, a horrible incident happen in a place where it's supposedly gun-free and the bad guy is the only guy with a gun, or in a place that has accessibility to guns and people could defend themselves? So it's a tough one.
Yeah. Well, changing tacks for just a minute, without giving anything away or even mentioning the book, what has it been like for you to kill off a character, and how have your readers reacted?
Oh, I know exactly what you're talking about.
That was a bombshell, let me tell you.
what's very, everybody who brings that up, I said, how many times did you read that page? And they all say three or four. Because it's so surprising. And I thought it was just important to me, and I think to readers, to throw a kink into a book and have something happen that rarely happens in a novel, because then they know that anything can happen and there's never a formula.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was kind of crushed because I loved that particular character of yours, and I kept waiting for the twist in the novel that meant perhaps he wasn't really dead.
So, right.
Yeah.
And I think it served the purpose in the book, and I'm already writing a sequel to that one with the other character, and I like the idea of kind of a baton being passed.
Yeah, I definitely saw that, and I applaud your bravery, because that would have been a huge franchise, I think. But anyway, okay, back to Joe Pickett. Are there any plans for development for movies or TV for him?
Right now the series is being pitched as a television series by Robert Redford is the executive producer, and I think they're going from network to network right now making that pitch, literally as we speak. So who knows, there may be some news on that front.
Wow, that's major. Stone Cold ends with sort of a bombshell at the end, so are you already at work at number 15 in the series?
Yes, I am. The next book will begin literally right after Stone Cold, with those threads that are kind of left out there.
Right. And do you juggle sort of spending a part of the day on that series versus the one that we just were alluding to?
No, I don't ever work on them both at the same time. Mm-hmm. I'm always afraid that something will bleed over from one book, from a standalone, into the series or vice versa. So I just basically start and complete a book and then go to the next one, whether it's in the series or a standalone.
And is there like a new series percolating in your brain that introducing totally new characters, or are you going to stick with these?
I'm going to stick with these for a while, but with the standalones, you never know what's going to happen.
All right. Well, I really loved Stone Cold, and I'm still rolling it over in my brain about the mystery book that we won't talk about with the bombshell ending. Readers, that means you have to read all of them. So
that's right.
Okay. Thanks so much, CJ.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
And now let's listen to a sample of Stone Cold, narrated by David Chandler.
There was no doubt, Nate had been told, that the world would be a better place without Henry P. Scoggins III in it. Scoggins was short, fleshy, stooped, and wall-eyed, and was the last direct heir of the Scoggins pharmaceutical empire of Newark, New Jersey. Unlike his grandfather, the senator and ambassador, or his father, the well-intentioned philanthropist, Henry III, as he was known, used his billions to manipulate monetary currencies around the world, corner the market on 14 of 17 rare earth metals, and lavishly fund activist groups that advocated legalized prostitution, drug use, and polygamy. He enjoyed the company of corrupt machine politicians, gangster rap artists, foreign dictators, and domestic organized crime figures. Several of his lurid divorce proceedings were front-page news over the years, as well as the Los Angeles murder trial, where he'd been accused of shooting a hooker in the face and killing her on the front porch of his mansion. He'd been found innocent when the jury bought his lawyer's claim that Scoggins mistook her for a homicidal home invader threatening his Beverly Hills neighborhood at the time. In video clips, Scoggins spoke in a deliberate mid-register timbre that belied his habit of constantly and furtively looking over the heads of the listeners, as if searching for someone more worthwhile, better looking, or less threatening in the room. He'd the arrogant look of a bully who had insulated himself so he'd never have to directly confront a challenge, the kind of man comfortable with rewarding his friends in person and punishing his enemies from a distance. Isolating the man was the problem. Scoggins surrounded himself with armed bodyguards, and his five U.S.-based homes, Newark, Manhattan, Aspen, Palm Beach, and the infamous Beverly Hills manse, were set up with elaborate security systems. His overseas properties in Caracas, Abu Dhabi, and Grand Cayman were protected by security contractors who were ex-black ops. Few people were aware of the $6 million log home Scoggins had recently purchased through a holding company on the bank of the Bighorn River. The reason? He wanted to learn to fly fish. The rumor was that Scoggins thought he was buying the river itself. For the past week, in addition to the late-night reconnaissance floats, Nate had scouted the Scoggins property on the ground by trespassing through an adjoining landholding and avoiding the caretaker. There were very few private residences in the river valley, and the few that were there were massive and expensive. They were accessed by a private road that paralleled the bends of the river. Only a couple of the structures could be seen from the road itself due to high stone walls and steel security gates. The Scoggins property had not only a swinging gate operated by remote control, but also a small guardhouse manned by an armed employee during daylight hours. At night, visitors, mostly delivery trucks, had to identify themselves via the closed-circuit camera at the gate to be buzzed in. Additional closed-circuit cameras that swept the grounds were mounted on poles within the compound.
That was Stone Cold by CJ Box. Another thriller set in the wilderness is Destroyer Angel by Nevada Barr. It's book 17 in the Anna Pigeon series, so you know the author has a winning formula. Anna is a U.S. Park Service ranger who set off on an autumn canoe trip in upstate Minnesota with her friend Heath, a paraplegic, Heath's 15-year-old daughter Elizabeth, Leah, and Leah's 13-year-old daughter Katie. For Heath and Leah, this is a shakedown cruise to test Leah's new line of camping equipment geared to make camping and canoeing more accessible for the disabled. On their second night out, things go terribly awry. Anna goes off on her own for a solo evening float down the river. When she comes back, she finds that four thugs, armed with rifles and pistols, have taken her friends captive. With limited resources and no access to the outside world, Anna has only 2 days to rescue them. The incomparable Barbara Rosenblatt performs the book.
Pride cometh jeering at the most inopportune moments. Still, she hoped she hadn't wet her pants, that she wasn't panicking. She'd been a climber, for Christ's sake. It was not a sport for cowards, at least not physical cowards. There had been a time she'd been afraid of life, afraid to live without two good legs. But that was years ago, before she'd fallen in love with the little girl who was to become her daughter. Now it was E who was turning her craven. Overcoming fear for oneself was a piece of cake compared to overcoming fear for one's child. Pushing up on one elbow, she took most of her weight off of E's back while managing to stay between her and the gun. Not that her scrawny body would do much good. Though she'd never owned a gun, never shot one, and never wanted to, Heath had lived in Colorado all her life. She couldn't help but absorb a modicum of ambient knowledge. Fired at close range, a bullet could go through one person and kill whoever was behind. Still, as insubstantial as she was better than nothing. She might get lucky. And if the dude... Lord, to be shot by a man called the dude! She'd die of shame before she had time to bleed to death. If the dude pulled the trigger, maybe her bones, a zipper, or a button would deflect the bullet and save E. Until Anna could rescue them. That was the thought she wouldn't articulate to herself. That was a hell of a burden to put on one small, unarmed girlfriend. Heath couldn't help but hope. Anna was smart. She was resourceful. With a couple of miracles and a lot of luck. Anyway, Heath was careful not to raise her eyes to the woods. Listen too intently for the soft fall of moccasins on leaves, or otherwise telegraph Anna's presence. She prayed that Leah, Elizabeth, and Katie would have the good sense to do the same. A sensible person would have hopped in the canoe and paddled for help. But Heath knew Anna hadn't. She couldn't, no more than Heath could shut off her fear for Elizabeth. Anna was out there. As long as the four of the apocalypse didn't realize that, there was a chance. Elizabeth wouldn't give Anna away. Heath could count on her. Trauma had not destroyed E. It had made her wiser than her years. Leah might be the smartest human being on the planet, but Heath had no idea what the scientist would do when she and her daughter were the lab rats. If Heath, who'd once made her living leading difficult climbs, had very possibly pissed herself in terror, what must an otherworldly brainiac be suffering? Leah didn't share her inner self with the world. Not even, apparently, with her soul offspring. Docile as a robot, with the power switched off, she was watching the pot-bellied scumbag retie Katie's wrists with plastic ties. Shock, Heath told herself. Leah wasn't used to not being in control. After a day and a half with Katie, Heath guessed Katie would offer Jesus Christ up to the Romans if she thought it would get her an extra hour of TV a night. Katie would give up Anna in a heartbeat if she saw any profit in it. Then again, if there was nothing to be gained, Katie might keep the secret to her grave, just to spite the riffraff who dared handle her so roughly. Putting her lips so close to E's ear she could smell the wood smoke in her hair, Heath whispered, "Elizabeth." Beneath her cheek, Elizabeth's head nodded fractionally. "Play. Dead." Foolish as it might be, E, flat to the ground, not moving, not looking in the direction of the men, made Heath less afraid for her. Rather like pulling the covers over your head so the monster in the closet won't eat you, she mocked herself. "Get up."
We've just heard Destroyer Angel by Nevada Barr. At the opening of Alice LaPlante's A Circle of Wives, Dr. John Taylor is found dead in a hotel room, a victim of foul play. Detective Samantha Adams is thrown into a high-profile murder case more intricately intertwined than she could ever imagine. A renowned plastic surgeon, a family man, and an upstanding member of the community, Dr. Taylor seemed to be loved and admired. But he led a secret life, in fact, multiple lives. The good Dr. Taylor was married to three very different women in three separate cities. When the unsuspecting wives show up at his funeral, suspicions run high. Adams soon finds herself tracking down a murderer through a web of lies and marital discord. The question looms, how well can a person really know their spouse? An ensemble cast performs the book.
I am nothing if not irresolute. Excuse the double negative. What I mean to say is that there is little I won't waver over. You know how squirrels flirt with death by the roadside, and how some actually lose their heads and rush into traffic to their doom? I had to give up riding my bike around campus as an undergraduate because of those damn squirrels. They'd make a dash for my tires, and if I would just hold firm and keep going, chances were good they'd scamper back to safety. But if they'd freak, I'd freak. And the result was too many crashes, too many injuries. I walked everywhere my junior and senior years. So, a waverer I am. Peter and I are at Cook's Seafood Store on El Camino. We're warmly greeted as we walk in. I love this place because the men behind the counter, all men, a variety of ages between 20 and 70, look so happy to be there. I believe the word to describe them is fishmongers. Such a lovely word. And apparently a lovely place to work, as most of them have been there for decades. I like the way they closely attend to customers describing their dinner plans, how they take the time to think before suggesting the exact number of shrimp for a party of four, the precise weight of ahi tuna for six. No, they can't recommend the mackerel. It's a bit spongy today. Then, after placing the slabs of raw fish or the handfuls of shellfish on the scale, they wrap the purchases in crisp white paper as carefully as if they were the most special of birthday gifts. The taking of money appears a casual afterthought. The real business of the place is in the human interactions. If I were lonely, here is where I would come for solace. The store is crowded, but we're patient. They know what we want, and sure enough, there's a wink and a broad smile from Eddie today, and out comes a beautiful specimen of smelt, Hypomysis transpacificus, that Peter has been seeking for quite some time. The fact that I use the words beautiful and smelt together in a sentence shows what living with Peter has done to me. As usual, Peter jingles the coins in his pocket, and as usual, Eddie waves him off. Peter is a scientist, an anthropologist, or, to be strictly honest, an academic wannabe. His doctoral dissertation involves researching the diets of the indigenous peoples of the San Francisco Bay Area. He spent all last summer across the bay at the Emeryville Shell Mound, wallowing thigh-deep in what they now know is a toxic swamp. He will take this tiny smelt home and dehydrate it, carefully preserving the skeleton, and use it as a model to draw in his workbook. I'm wild about his meticulous sketches of these dried carcasses. For pleasure, I often go leafing through the pages of his dissertation notes, and for my birthday, I requested to have two of my favorites copied and framed. He thought I was kidding. But no. The delicate renderings of the fragile structures truly delight me. God is in those bones. So here's where we are. Together, almost 10 years after we met in freshman rhetoric, and I helped him understand the difference between its, and which, and that, we became instantly inseparable, although I hesitated to call myself committed. It's not a word I would use, ever, to describe myself. Now, a decade later, Peter is still in school, and I'm still wavering. I wavered my way from an undergraduate degree in history into a quickly terminated semester of law school, then into a master's program in education, and then less than a full term teaching 8th grade social studies in nearby Portola Valley, recently rated the 2nd richest town in America by Time magazine. And here's something else you should know about me. In addition to being irresolute, I'm also a quitter. I'm not ashamed. I find that it often takes more courage to stop doing something you despise than to continue blindly along the wrong path. You usually save yourself, and others, a lot of grief.
That was A Circle of Wives by Alice LaPlante. The Cairo Affair is Olin Steinhauer's wonderfully reviewed spy thriller, set in Europe and Egypt against the backdrop of the Arab Spring. The story begins as Sophie Cole, the wife of a mid-level diplomat at the American Embassy in Hungary, begins to tell her husband she had had an affair while they were posted to Cairo. Moments later, her husband is shot and killed. Stan Bertoli, a Cairo-based CIA agent, is shocked to hear the voice of the only woman he ever truly loved, as she calls to ask him why her husband had been assassinated. Omar Halawi is a seasoned pro in the Egyptian intelligence service. Foreign agents pass him intel? He returns the favor. But the murder of the diplomat in Hungary is rippling all the way to Cairo, and Omar must follow the clues wherever they lead. The plot unveils in layers, each chapter revealing a new shade of meaning. As these players converge in Cairo, the author's masterful manipulations slowly unveil a portrait of marriage, a jigsaw puzzle of loyalty and betrayal set against the dangerous world of politics. Eduardo Ballerini narrates.
On February 19, 2011, 2 days after the Day of Revolt, the first kidnapping occurred in London. And over the following 72 hours, similar scenes occurred in Brussels, Paris, and New York. In only 3 days, 5 politically active Libyan exiles vanished from the face of the earth. Yusuf al-Juwali, Abdurrahim Zargoun, Walid Bilaj, Abdel Jalil, and Mohammed el-Kaib. Word of these abductions reached Langley along the usual paths. Updates from the cousins, intercepted emails, news feeds, and worried reports from friends and colleagues. Yet the computer algorithms somehow missed the possibility that they were part of a single event. It took a researcher in the Office of Collection Strategies and Analysis, Jibril Aziz, to see the connection. As a native Libyan who had been reared on the anxieties of his family's political exile, he was primed to find connections where others wouldn't be looking. And his enthusiasm sometimes meant that he found connections where they didn't actually exist. Jibril worked in the original headquarters building in an office the size of 3. For in 1991, a contractor had altered the penitentiary-like 1950s design by bringing down 2 walls, finally connecting all the members of the North Africa section of Collection Strategies. Jibril was one of 15 analysts in that long room, each half-hidden behind cubicle walls, and occasionally they coalesced at one end to puzzle over the decade-old coffee maker and joke about their view, which was largely obscured by sculpted rhododendron bushes. Though if they stood on tiptoe, they could catch sight of the busy parking lot. At 33, Jibril was the youngest analyst in Collection Strategies. Before coming across the disappearances on Tuesday, February 22nd, Jibril had spent his lunch break eating a meal packed by his wife, Inaya, and verifying the translation of a just-broadcast speech by Muammar Gaddafi, who had rambled for more than an hour in a diatribe against rats and agents, and rats and cats, and those rats who've taken the tablets. If they're not following Gaddafi, who would they follow? Somebody with a beard? Impossible. The people are with us, supporting us. These are our people. I've brought them up. Everywhere they are shouting slogans in support of Muammar Gaddafi. After this depressing chore, he tried to divert himself with the Libya-related reports that had come in over the transom, searching for something, anything, to buoy his spirits. This was how he came across the disappearances. And when he read of them, he felt as if a light had been turned on. Finally, something palpably real after the fantasy mutterings of a dictator. He was excited in the aesthetic way that all researchers are when they've discovered connections where previously nothing existed. Yet there was more. There was Stumbler. To reach his direct supervisor, Jibril had to walk down the corridor, steeling himself against the sharp aroma of disinfectant, and climb a set of noisy stairs, then wait in Jake Copeland's anteroom, often chatting with researchers from the Europe and South America sections as they all waited for a word with the boss. Because of the state of the world, the Asia section had recently begun reporting directly to Copeland's superior. So beyond the weekly reports and biweekly meetings that brought the whole world together, no one really knew what was happening in that part of the globe. "They're doing it," Jibril said once he'd gained access. He spread 5 pages across Copeland's desk, each with a photo, 10 lines of bio, and the circumstances of the man's disappearance.
"It?
Stumbler, Jake. It's on.
Slow down. Take a breath."
Jibril finally took a chair, leaned forward, and used a long brown finger to point at each of the faces.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5. All gone, just as the plan says. That's step one, by the book."
Copeland frowned, rubbing an eye with the heel of his hand.
"Check your inbox," Jibril commanded. "I sent you the memo."
Copeland pulled up his email. He scrolled through Jibril's report.
That was The Cairo Affair by Olin Steinhauer. Anne Perry's wildly popular mysteries are set in the glorious reign of Queen Victoria. Death on Blackheath is the 29th installment of the Charlotte and Thomas Pitt series. As commander of the powerful special branch, Thomas Pitt has the job of keeping Britain safe from spies and traitors. So why is he suddenly ordered to investigate 2 minor incidents? The blood, hair, and shards of glass discovered outside the home of naval weapons expert Dudley Kynaston, and the simultaneous disappearance of Mrs. Kynaston's lady's maid. But weeks later, when the mutilated body of an unidentified young woman is found near Kynaston's home, Pitt realizes this is no ordinary police investigation. Is Kynaston, one of Britain's most valuable scientists, leading a double life? A baffled Pitt turns to his wife and colleagues to help him solve the case. Davina Porter narrates.
The thought occurred to him that without the telephone to waken him at his home in Keppel Street on the other side of the river, he would have been having breakfast in his own warm kitchen now, unaware of any of this potential tragedy and all the grief and complications that could arise from it. He grunted agreement, but before he could add anything more, he heard rapid footsteps along the pavement. The next moment, Stoker appeared at the top of the areaway. He was the one man in Special Branch that Pitt had learned to trust. After the betrayals that had led to Victor Narraway's dismissal, he trusted no one who had not earned it. Narraway had been innocent of any wrongdoing, and after desperate effort and cost, had been proved so. But the events in Ireland had still been the end of his career at Special Branch. "Morning, sir," Stoker said, with only the slightest curiosity in his voice. He glanced down at the lantern and the patch of stone steps illuminated by it, then at Pitt.
He was a lean man with a strong, intelligent face, although it was a bit too bony to be good-looking and too dour for charm. "There was some sort of scuffle here, and a maid of the house appears to be missing," Pitt explained. He looked up at the sky, then back at Stoker. "Make a note of exactly what you see. Draw it. Then pick up a few samples in case we need them in evidence one day. Better hurry. If the rain comes, it'll wash that whole lot away. I'm going in to speak to the household."
"Yes, sir. Why us, sir? A quarrel, a missing maid? What's wrong with the locals doing it?"
He gave the sergeant a nod, but the question was directed at Pitt.
"Householder is Dudley Kynaston, Naval Defence," Pitt replied.
Stoker swore under his breath. Pitt smiled, glad not to have caught his exact words, although he probably agreed with them. He turned and knocked on the scullery door, then opened it, walking past the stored bins of vegetables and into the kitchen. Immediately the warmth wrapped around him, along with the rich aromas of food cooking. It was comfortable, everything in order. Polished copper pans hung from hooks, their sheen winking in the light. Clean china was stacked on the dresser. Shelves were piled neatly with labelled spice jars. Strings of onions and dried herbs hung from the rafters.
"Good morning," he said clearly.
And three women turned from their tasks to look at him.
"Morning, sir," they replied, almost in unison.
The cook was a comfortably rounded woman, at the moment holding a large wooden spoon in her hand. A maid in a starched and lace-trimmed apron was setting out tea and toast, ready to carry upstairs. And another maid was peeling potatoes. She had dark, unruly hair and wide eyes. As soon as he saw her, Pitt knew that she was the one who had gone outside and found the blood and glass. The sleeves of her grey dress were rolled well above her elbows, and her white apron was covered in smuts from relighting the stove. The cook regarded Pitt apprehensively, unsure where to place him in the social scale. He wasn't a gentleman, because he had come in through the back door, and he didn't have the natural arrogance of a man used to the attention of servants. On the other hand, he seemed very sure of himself in a different kind of way, and she could tell at a glance that his overcoat was of excellent quality. In the circumstances, he was probably a policeman of some sort, but he didn't look like an ordinary sergeant. Pitt gave her a brief smile.
"May I speak to your scullery maid, please? I would appreciate it if you could give me a quiet room where we will be without interruption. If you wish the housekeeper to be with her while we speak, that will be acceptable."
He phrased it as a request, but it was an order, and he held her eyes long enough to be certain that she knew that.
"Yes, sir," she said, her voice catching as though her mouth were dry. "Dora here can go with her."
She gestured at the startled parlour maid.
"I'll take that tray up to Mrs. Kynaston. Maisie, you go with the policeman and tell him what he needs to know. And you be civil, mind."
"Yes, cook," Maisie said obediently, and led Pitt as far as the door.
Then she turned to him, looking him up and down with bright, critical eyes.
"You look like you're froze to the bone. You want a cup of tea, sir?"
We've just heard Death on Blackheath by Anne Perry. Readers, we've been on the trail of some wonderfully engaging crime stories. Hopefully, the best choices are a mystery no longer. If crime is not your beat, be sure to check my website, bookreportradio.com, for clues on what to read next. Thanks for riding along with me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report.